There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, your chance to hear everything we've been doing off air and everything that's interesting us off air in one handy, efficiently bite-sized podcast. First, here are the business headlines we've been looking at this morning.
Dubai Eye 103.8 Business Headlines.
In association with insurancemarket.ae.
Analysts say real estate agents could be sidelined after Dubai announced plans to put all property transactions online by 2020. And Abu Dhabi's stock market has signed a deal to explore blockchain technology. It says blockchain could make trading faster and more efficient.
British Trade Secretary Liam Fox says more British companies are targeting the UAE. That is after the UAE announced 10-year visas and 100% foreign ownership. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabian media mogul Waleed Al Ibrahim is set to visit Dubai for the first time since spending time in the Riyadh Ritz-Carlton. He is the chairman of the TV network NBC, which is based here.
The EU is proposing a ban on single-use plastics that it says could protect the environment and save consumers money. Items that could be outlawed include straws, plastic cutlery and cotton buds. And the cost of your daily commute is set to rise by nearly 6% next month. Fuel prices are going to increase in June to reflect the higher oil price, with super rising to 2 dirham 63 and special up to 2 dirham 51.
Dubai Eye 103.8 Business Headlines.
In association with insurancemarket.ae. Compare insurance for your car, health, home or business with insurancemarket.ae.
One big story of the day today.
Our house in the middle of
And that is the Dubai Land Department's announcement of a new transaction platform online, blockchain, we assume, for real estate transactions. Going to come into force in the first quarter of 2020, this is part of a wider initiative to develop smart, what would you call them, smart solutions for Dubai as part of the Dubai 10x10 initiative. We've heard a few of them lately. This one, though, I think this is a bit of a game changer, Mark. What do you reckon?
I think so. It's up there with 10-year visas and 100% company ownership in terms of change. It's something that could affect very much estate agents for a start, but it just changes the way we're going to be looking at property. Perhaps the number of transactions would increase if it's easier to do. Maybe we'll find getting in and out of property transactions. We'll buy and sell more, perhaps move house more often. I'm not quite sure what the charges are going to be for all of this, because if it's exactly the same price as using the estate agent, you know, whether you go online or do it face-to-face is probably neither here nor there. But I suspect the costs will be a lot lower.
Well, that's kind of the point of using blockchain technology and bringing stuff online, isn't it? Digitising to bring the costs down. The big question in the Business Breakfast this morning has been, what does it mean for property managers and estate agents?
And on a wider note, what does it mean for Dubai? Because obviously if you put everything online and retail shrinking as we move to online sales and, you know, what happens to all the industries? What are we going to see a reduced population here in Dubai eventually because of this?
We're going to hear from Craig Plum in just a moment, and he is the head of research for JLL, the property people in this region. We're going to get his take on what it means. First, though, we spoke to Linda Mahoney, the woman behind Better Homes, a few days ago. We were talking, ironically, before this announcement, about what technology, AI, meant for the real estate industry in general. She reckons we're always going to need people. Take a listen to this.
With artificial intelligence, nobody really can see the future from that perspective. But Brandy's just said, she's seen villas without an agent. It really doesn't work that way. I mean, you have to find the stock, but actually there will be human interaction all the time. In medicine, you have artificial intelligence, but you still need people behind it. In my opinion, it's more about handling problems as they come along, because artificial intelligence is not one of them, I don't think. We see Uber every day, and look at what's happened with Uber. Has that caused major problems? I think has been an asset. All these things have added to help make things more efficient and smoother. So I think the digital real estate is not something that we don't enjoy. We enjoy getting into it, and we've been doing that really from the day the website came out.
And I hear her point, but It's whether or not you're getting the service from those people. We're going to hear from Craig Plum in a moment. And one of the points that he's going to make is that real estate agents are possibly going to have to up their game. And we've all got a couple of horror stories. I say shown a flat in the marina, and I say shown in inverted commas because I was the only person there. I had arranged to see it. They said, let yourself in.
You showed yourself a flat there.
I showed myself a flat. Should have paid myself 5%, Malcolm. I let myself in. I had a look around. There was mould, which I'm used to from Wellington and I'm not used to from Dubai, in the back
of... green mould.
Oh, the sort of the mildewy mould. Yeah, the black stuff in the back of the cupboards. And when I got in touch with the real estate agent, waking him up, I'm pretty sure, he said, well, don't worry. Once you sign a contract and pay a deposit, we'll get rid of it.
Once you've moved in, we'll kind of send somebody around and have a look at it.
That's a bit like, yeah, nah.
Yeah, thank you.
But this is Craig Plum, the head of research from JLL, telling us what he thinks this announcement means for the industry and for the people who make their money in it.
I think that nothing will change overnight. This is just another step in the direction that Dubai is moving in. Basically what has happened is that the Land Department has announced this platform which they're calling REST, Real Estate Self Transaction. The idea is that and this has been announced previously, that the Dubai government wants to enable all real estate transactions to be done online through blockchain by 2020. So as it stands today, you cannot buy a unit totally online in Dubai still. You still have to do some paperwork and there still have to be signatures and various other things. But this is a move by the government to move away from the paperwork, from the need to get documents authorized and notarized. But it's not really going to have any immediate impact on the market, probably for another year to 18 months.
Once it does come in the first quarter of 2020, our big question on the Business Breakfast is this. If you can do the entire transaction online from any country, and this includes rental as well and the payment of electricity bills and all the rest of it, will we have any need for property managers and real estate agents?
There clearly will be less need. But remember, a lot of transactions you can do directly anyway. There's no law that says at the moment you have to have a broker or you have to have a property manager. What it will mean, of course, is that the brokers and the property managers will have to earn their keep and that they'll have to show that they can add value to the process. Because at the moment, you do have that choice to go direct to the owner, and a lot of the major developers are obviously selling directly rather than using brokers or agents. So it will certainly continue that trend, but it won't be the total death knell for property brokers or for managing agents.
What about for renting, though? Because we know there are a lot of overseas landlords that are renting and they use real estate agents as their representative on the ground. If they're able to deal with you directly through this portal, will we see a lot more rental arrangements, rental agreements being made without a middleman?
Yes. I mean, the answer is that's a continued trend. We will see more rental agreements without a middleman. But as I say, to go back to my point, that the agent can still have a role to play. They're just going to have to show that they can add value to the process. And obviously that role could be in terms of negotiating a better price or a better rental, depending on which side of the agent is working for. But if you as an agent can show that maybe the landlord is asking for a price of $100,000 and you can negotiate that down to $90,000, yeah, there's still going to be value for an agent. But the short answer to your question is that there's going to be more deals done direct, so there'll be less going through agents, that's for sure.
What is this going to mean, finally, Craig, for the cost of buying, selling or renting property to transaction fees, to brokerage fees? I know we're speculating a little bit, but what do you see happening there?
It can only reduce those overall costs. There is already some pressure in a soft market like we have at the moment. There is already pressure to reduce those transactions costs, which are around 4%, obviously as a tax, and then other costs on top of that. Streamlining the processes and going online will make it cheaper to buy and sell and cheaper to rent. So it's going to be good for the market from that perspective, because it'll reduce the costs involved.
What about the blockchain element, Craig? We speak about blockchain, we speak about things being faster, but we also speak about them being more secure. What's the need there?
I think it's a case of a bit of both. Just one interesting way to look at this story is that it's part of the overall evolution of the market towards a blockchain environment. We were with a developer recently at the land department, and they were saying that up to 30% of their sales, they're not able to register with the land department because they still need to get a physical signature. The land department is still requiring the developers to give them a physical signature of the person who's bought the apartment. And a lot of these buyers are obviously overseas. A lot of the developers are actually struggling. So this particular developer was one of the biggest ones in Dubai. 30% of their sales over in this particular project, they couldn't register on the land department because they didn't have the signature of the buyer. Now, that's obviously going to streamline this. If you don't need that physical signature anymore, that immediately removes that blockage. And it's going to speed up the process. So it's a good move. It's all for a more efficient market. It's going to reduce costs and improve efficiency.
Craig Plum, Head of Research at JLL, thank you very much for speaking to us on the Business Breakfast this morning.
Thank you, Brandy. Good morning.
This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
Now, plastic sucky things, will they be here for very long? Because the European Union is proposing a ban on single-use plastics to help protect marine life. One of those, of course, is straws, but it also includes cotton buds, cutlery, balloon sticks, drink stirrers. The EU wants almost all plastic bottles as well to be collected for recycling by 2025. In other words, they are trying to rid ourselves of plastic that hangs around in the universe, in the oceans, for quite a lot of time and doesn't biodegrade very quickly, because it's affecting animals, and it just clogs up everything, really. It clogs up sewers, it clogs up the sea, it clogs up the intestines of dolphins and whales, and they want to stop it. They want to stamp it out, make us all healthier, and them.
The big question is, how do you go about doing this? What the EU is looking to do, and of course everyone needs to vote on this and agree, is have a ban, and then also give incentives to the people who make these kind of things to make them out of better materials, bamboo and the like, poor pandas, but also looking to make them pay for some of the ocean cleanup costs as well. In the same way, the reasons we have tax on cigarettes, in theory, is so that you can pay for the hospital care that you will need 20 years down the road. Similar thing. I've been looking this morning about how different places in the States are doing it. There's a bill proposed in New York at the moment that would see a ban, but would also see a fine, $100 or more, to anyone who violated it. Presumably that would mean a restaurant providing you a straw rather than someone walking around with a straw sticking out of their Coke, but who knows? And in California, there's a proposed bill that could make it illegal for anyone in a restaurant to give you a straw unless you'd requested one. So, unsolicited straws would become illegal, punishable, by the way, by a fine of up to $1,000 or even jail time if this bill goes through. But they can give you a straw if you ask.
Psst, bud, want a straw?
People standing on street corners with small containers of straws.
I don't know. It's a strange one, really, that you could make it law to prohibit giving out something seemingly so innocent. But I'm looking here at a graphic of what happens to things. Cotton buds, for instance, most of them are actually flushed down the toilet, which surprises me. I mean, have you ever flushed one down the toilet?
No.
Just throw it away in a waste bin.
Yeah.
But it goes down the toilet. They pass through fine screens. They get into the rivers and seas. So they're very small, so they pass through most of the meshes. They break down over time into smaller fragments. UV rays start the process, and then that's continued by oxidization when they're in the water. And then the fish and marine life can't actually distinguish them from little bits of food, so they start to eat them, and then they get stuck in the intestines, which is the big danger. So, to me, I would have thought it was more educating people to make sure that things were disposed of properly, in very much the same way that we put things into green bins and black bins.
Well, I think that every jurisdiction around the world is trying to figure out the best way to do this, but regardless, it's happening. I mean, we can see which way the plastic bag is blowing, so to speak. This is definitely going to come into force around the world, one way or the other.
This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
And in news stories, the French firm Aegis has been awarded a project management consultancy contract for the development of the UAE's railway network. This is stage two and stage three. They're going to add about 600 kilometres in stage two, 250 in stage three. Emirates has announced that it's taking its A380, which came from Hamburg 10 years ago, to be introduced to service
back there. It's going to introduce two flights a day going forward, starting later this year. EK is also, of course, going to fly from Dubai to London Stansted from the 8th of June. 10 daily flights between Dubai and London. And Kareem customers now are going to have the option to book rides on electric vehicles in Dubai. And Oman's southern coast is getting back to normal after the hit from Cyclone Makunu. Salalah received the equivalent of 5 years' rain in just 4 days.
This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
What's on the Business Breakfast? Richard has been speaking to the British Trade Secretary, Dr. Liam Fox, talking about how the UAE's new visa and foreign ownership laws could be a boost for UK investors.
As we leave the European Union, we're very much focused on the economic opportunities that exist outside Europe, and the International Monetary Fund tell us that 90% of global growth will occur outside Europe in the next 10 to 15 years. The Middle East and the Gulf in particular will be a very important part of that.
You've recently appointed a trade envoy, for want of a better word, Simon Penny. Explain the rationale behind that move.
As you know, he's previously the head of wholesale and international banking at First Gulf Bank and CEO of the Middle East and North Africa for Royal Bank of Scotland, and he has a substantial experience working overseas, including in the region. So he's a big hire from the private sector to the Department for International Trade. And our trade commissioners are responsible for three things. They're responsible for promoting British exports in the region. They're responsible for getting foreign direct investment into the UK from the region. But they're also responsible for getting British companies to invest in the region. So those three functions, all extremely important in the continuing healthy bilateral relationship that we have. And Simon's extraordinarily well placed to do that. And of course, he will be centred in Dubai.
Of course, of those three, for any destination country, foreign investment from the UK into that country, the UAE in our case, is the most exciting. What kind of investments can we look forward to?
I've just been out discussing with the nuclear industry in Abu Dhabi, for example, how we might be able to help with our experience in things like maintenance, how we might help with nuclear waste, how we might help with supply chains in that. And remember, there's a very strong bilateral trading relationship. Bilateral trade between us is worth £14.6 billion last year. That's up nearly 15% from the year before. The UK is the number one source of foreign direct investment into the UAE, and it's our fourth largest export market outside Europe. As your listeners will all know, we have 100,000 UK nationals living here and 5,000 UK companies doing business in UAE. So we'll want to look across a whole range of sectors to see where we can take that relationship forward. As I said, everything from the nuclear industry to retail.
The UAE is in the process of loosening its foreign investment rules, for example, potentially offering 100% foreign ownership to UK firms that are onshore here in the UAE. How attractive is the UAE as a destination now for UK companies in terms of ease of doing business, and what difference could a move like this make to UK companies?
Well, this is an enormously welcome move, because wherever we can have an improved ease of doing business, that's likely to improve the prosperity between us. And the issuing of long-term visas and the announcement on foreign ownership are both extremely welcome. It's the sort of signals that investors will want to see about the openness of an economy. We pride ourselves in the UK of being Britain open for business, and it's lovely to see the UAE increasingly open for business too.
If we look at a couple of final questions, one of them is, of course, aviation. It's a massive sector here. And one of the talking points on our show this morning was the development and expansion of Heathrow or perhaps some other international airport in and around London. What can you tell us about, A, the importance of getting something like this done? Aviation ties, of course, crucial to those trade ties. And what might happen in that aviation space in and around London?
Many of us are very keen to see the further expansion of Heathrow. Whether that will provide us with enough capacity remains to be seen, or whether we'll have to have extra aircraft capacity in London. On top of that, we are, of course, improving our regional capacity, because London's not the only destination in the UK. In fact, increasingly we're seeing investments from places like the UAE into places like Birmingham, and we're seeing a lot of investment into Manchester and the north of England, as well as into Scotland. So we do need to improve those links. We already have 440 direct flights between the UK and the UAE every week, and that clearly shows the demand that is there. So we have to look at the UK capacity to ensure that we can continue to improve those, and the government will make a decision on what happens about the next Heathrow runway in a short time.
And finally, in terms of Brexit, what can you tell us about where we stand at the moment with Brexit negotiations and what you foresee happening next?
We want there to be a full, open and comprehensive trade agreement with the European Union. That's very important for both sides, not least the fact that the European Union has a surplus in goods trade of almost £100 billion with the UK. In order to maintain the well-being of European companies, they will need to continue to get access tariff-free to the UK. In terms of process, the next thing is that we have the June Council of the European Union coming up, when Britain will present what we think would be our preferred arrangement for that future trading partnership. Then we will leave the European Union at the end of March, including the Customs Union, the end of March 2019, and then we will have an implementation period which will give businesses time to adapt to any new environment between then and the end of December 2020.
That's the voice of Dr. Liam Fox. He is the UK Secretary of State for International Trade, talking to us yesterday on a trip to Abu Dhabi.
This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
We've also been speaking this morning about what incentivizes you to take a job. New research out from Michael Page, the recruitment and headhunting people, shows that we're all interested in perks. No surprise there. But just as importantly, we're choosing our jobs based on company culture. We've been speaking to Leith Ramsey, the Managing Director for this region at Michael Page.
Times are changing. I think last time when I was on here, I talked about the new era. I think people aren't chasing the dollar like they used to, and they're looking into more detail, and culture is a big part of that.
So tell us what your research found. I've got the numbers in front of me here. 95% of job seekers believe that corporate culture of a company is important. 92% say that benefits and perks are important. Let's drill down into those numbers a little bit.
Sure. Look, I think at a high level, we're not surprised that people think benefits are important and that culture is important. I think it's more the items within each of those studies. So if we look at corporate culture first, the three clear ones are clear vision, employee-focused and balanced, and transparent communication. So I think it's more looking at the items rather than thinking about whether or not culture is important or not.
Clear vision. How do you methodologically, how do you figure out that a company with a clear vision is something that's important to us when deciding whether or not to have a job?
Well, I think you need to explain it to your employees. I mean, I know myself in January, I stood up in front of the whole office and explained what was our target for this year, what was our target for next year. And the feedback that I had on that was fantastic. And I think the market changes out here so rapidly, and I think a lot of companies don't do that.
And the other things within the company culture that you identified, the top three, we'll get to the tangible perks in a second, but in terms of culture, so it was vision, it was...
employee-focused and balanced. So I think employees, we're quite demanding these days. We want a bit of everything. So I think due to social media, we're a lot more aware of what our colleagues and friends are getting at their companies. So I think that's part of the challenge for an organisation, is managing the expectations of the employees, that it's hard to have everything. So you have to work out in your own sort of hierarchy of needs what's important to you. And as a company, you have to work out what you can actually provide those employees.
Okay, so there's that. And then the transparency bit, the communication bit.
And that's probably the hardest, because there are sometimes, I think, employees aren't ready to hear the communication that's required, and particularly in a region like ours where it's quite unpredictable. But that's the challenge, I think, for all organisations, is to be two steps ahead, keeping employees informed, because otherwise you can have employees who are getting caught up in issues which either don't really affect them or aren't accurate in the first place.
How do you ascertain a company culture at the interview stage when both of you are putting on your best face? I mean, if you ask in an interview what a company's like, everyone's going to sit there and tell you the good stuff. They're not going to say, well, we actually encourage 18-hour days and the boss will text you at 2 in the morning.
Good question. I think these days candidates are a lot more informed. They'll jump on LinkedIn. They'll look at the backgrounds of the hiring manager, the previous hiring manager. They'll look and see how much turnover the company's had. So they already will have a very informed view at the start. They ask a lot more probing questions. I think on the organisation side, they're a lot more savvy to that, and they'll actually have more people in the interview process that they can meet, so a candidate can form their own opinion.
Do we really care about that more than the dollar, though? I mean, you said right at the beginning of this interview that you don't think people are chasing the money as much, and I'm going to challenge that. I think we're probably chasing it more than ever.
Look, we want both. We want everything. That's part of, I think, the Dubai culture. But given the unpredictable nature of the region, the culture and the benefits have become a lot more important. I think people, if they're going to move, there's a lot more risk attached to making a job move. So a 15% increase isn't enough these days.
So in terms of your customers, the big employers who are hiring and using firms like Michael Page to hire, they want to portray themselves as an employer of choice. That means people will want to work for them. They get the cream of the crop of candidates. Maybe they can even pay them a little bit less if they're seen as an employer of choice. How are you advising those companies? I know, the big airlines, the big motor companies, FMCG companies, whoever it is, how are you advising them to almost sell their company culture to candidates and to wear it as a badge of honour?
Well, I think that gets back to looking at the items that candidates are looking for. So aside from the standard things like accommodation and travel, training and education ongoing, that is a huge requirement for candidates in a job search. So being able to highlight, if and when you join our organisation, this is what your further development will look like in the first 1 to 2 years.
And actually, because you break it down into, what are the phrases you use? There are the tangible benefits like housing, transport, almost cash-based, and then there are the uncommon benefits like culture. But of the tangible ones, number one is housing, but number two is training.
Yes.
It's not cash that you get in your pocket. That comes above transport allowance. It comes above flexi time. It comes above education allowance.
Yep. Now, this gets back to my point that people aren't necessarily chasing the dollar, and Dubai is more of a long-term career opportunity choice for a lot of people now. So when they're assessing an organisation, they want to know, if I'm going to invest my time and my career in you, what am I going to get back? And training is something which is a lot higher on the agenda than, say, it was 5 years ago.
Are we getting a little more cynical about some of the cash benefits? I mean, I always think if someone offers me a 500 dirham a month transport allowance, what they're really doing is saying, we were going to pay you, I don't know, 30,000 dirhams, and now we're going to pay you 29,950. Plus, you can have a transport allowance.
Look, I think it depends from company to company how they structure their actual salary package. So by UA labour law, you need to have a basic salary, accommodation, a travel allowance and flight in there. On top of that, then you've got benefits, and companies will put together a different suite of benefits depending on the organisation. So FMCG companies, hospitality companies, technology companies are a lot better, I think, a lot more advanced in all the benefits that they offer their employees.
Are people beginning to care more about the work-life balance? We've just had a text in from someone who says they are obviously anonymous, but also says, I'm quitting my job next week for a lower paid job, but there's better culture and there's more balanced work-life environment.
The F word, flexibility. This is a great topic. I could be here all day discussing it. The thing about flexibility, it means different things to different people. So it's very hard to come up with a culture of flexibility that suits everyone. What you need to do is you need to understand on a one-to-one basis what flexibility means to each of your employees. Of course, have some broader guidelines, but flexibility is a very challenging one. I struggled with that myself, trying to offer flexibility to staff, because what it means to a 25-year-old can be very different to what it means to a 40-year-old.
But it is, if you look at this list of things, of tangible benefits, most of them will cost the firm money. Housing allowance, you've got to pay it out. Training, you've got to pay it out. Transport allowance, that's cash, and so on. Devices like a laptop, savings and schemes, they all cost money. The one on that list that doesn't cost you a bean, it doesn't cost the company a dime, is flexi time or flexible working hours. It's number four on the list, and it's free. So why aren't more companies doing it? Tell us, as a managing director, how you're addressing this.
So, I mean, what we've done actually at the start of the year is we had a program where all of the managers needed to sit down on a one-to-one basis with the consultants and understand what does flexibility mean to them. And to get back to the original point, is that different people require different things. So at a high level, we reduced the working hours so people could unilaterally say, okay, one particular day, or 2 days a week, I'm working 8:30 or 5:30. And you can choose which day you want to do that. Now, within that, some people want to go to the gym at lunchtime. For them, that's flexibility. Other people want to come in a bit later and go to the gym in the morning. That's flexibility for them. So it's a combination of, I think, having some corporate guidelines that affect everyone, but then really understanding at an employee level, what does it mean to them?
Fascinating discussion. Leith Ramsey is the Managing Director for the Middle East of Michael Page. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, guys.
That's it for the Bite Size Business Breakfast. We'll be back on air and online tomorrow with more.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.